All right, so we'll take a moment to bring our minds to rest. Letting go for a moment of all those activities of this life that have been taking all our attention and that got us here. So with appreciation for that, we'll do our prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, may roof or continent, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great lesser and uncommon. Dadan sen shantam che lo che su drawer zin ji lap tu sol. Chalam du drawer zin ji lap tu sol. Am chulpa sol or zin. Oh, wait a minute. I should let Lama Jinsang do the prayers. All right. So we'll do that after we do the meditation. Okay. So we're going to try to keep the meditation a little short today to give Lama Jinsang plenty of time for the sufferings of samsara, which are many and could fill many hours of class. So we're going to do hopefully a more abbreviated version of what we did last week, just thinking one more time about impermanence before we move on to the suffering of samsara. So we'll start, as always, by just bringing our mind to rest. And take a moment to contemplate the four thoughts or the four reminders that turn the mind away from being so absorbed in our worldly activities and towards activities that can actually help us at the time of death and through all adversity. First, the precious human existence. First, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make it meaningful. Secondly, everything is impermanent, the world and all it contains. In particular, the life of beings is as fragile as a bubble of water. The time of death is uncertain, and when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Thirdly, at the time of death, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must therefore refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day monitor my stream of being. And then the topic that we'll be exploring today and in the next session. Fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of existence continually torment me through the three types of suffering. They are like the last meal before my execution. I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish awakening. So we take a moment then to just come back to our open awareness, or you could be following the breath if you prefer. Just gathering our attention in a relaxed, alert way. And within that, requesting the blessing of the Lama, of the teacher we feel closest to, or it could be the Buddha. Visualizing them as vividly as possible above the crown of our head in a body of light on a lotus and moon seat, radiating love, compassion, bodhicitta. And with or without words, requesting their blessing to empower our practice so that we may accomplish the same level of love, compassion, and bodhicitta. Really feeling it in a heartfelt way that there's someone who has accomplished this and they can help us. It can help us to follow their example and to open our heart to them. And so we receive the blessings just by asking, and the teacher, the Lama, the Buddha, descends, this visualization descends into our heart center and comes to rest there. So we'll rest in open awareness again for a moment. This time with the power of the teacher's mind, the Buddha's mind, empowering our practice. And again, just for a moment, bring our attention to, we'll do a little bit of a contemplation and meditation. First, bring our attention to just how our life feels to us. Our activity level, our commitments, our work, our schedule. What does it feel like? Do we have too much to do, or is it easy to have breaks to relax our mind and rest in openness to do our practice? Remembering the second reminder that everything comes to an end, including our life, and we don't know when that will be. When we die, how much difference will it make each of the activities that we are currently committing our time to? What if we were to die right now? Would our priorities as we've been living them be of the utmost help to us as we go into the bardo and into our next life? On our deathbed, how will we feel about how we've spent our life? Will we have lived our priorities? If our life feels too busy, how might we make room in it, make more space in it for practice, for just resting in the nature of mind? So let's just breathe in whatever level of busyness and involvement we may feel in our lives, especially if it feels like too much. Breathing that in and breathing out spaciousness, relaxation, resting, peace, and liberation. Doing a few rounds like this with the texture of our life. Making a little space in the forward momentum to just rest. And now bringing to mind someone we love, someone we feel compassion for, someone we want the best for, naturally. And breathing in whatever busyness, whatever sort of overcommitment, overwork they may be experiencing, breathing that in and breathing out to them the same spaciousness and relaxation, peace of mind. And bringing to mind someone, anyone that we are aware of but don't feel a particular connection with, could be the birds in our backyard or passersby on the street, delivery people, store clerks, warehouse workers. Breathing in the same thing for them. The feeling of being too busy, the feeling of not enough time, the feeling of too many things to do. And breathing out spaciousness, rest, peace of mind. And if it's not too uncomfortable, adding someone that we have trouble with, that we might consider an enemy, that we might feel is harming us or harming others. Breathing in whatever they're dealing with in their day-to-day life and breathing out peace, happiness, relaxation, spaciousness, and perspective, a Dharma perspective. And now opening our awareness to all sentient beings in all six realms, which Lama Jinzang is going to guide us through in the next two sessions. Breathing in whatever busyness and whatever suffering each being has, letting it dissolve into our Buddha nature, which is vast, and breathing out whatever they need, including the space and time and ability to practice the Dharma and free themselves from suffering. Now taking a moment to appreciate this time that we have together to study, contemplate, and meditate, and wish that for all sentient beings. And now letting go of all visualization and all conceptuality and just coming back to rest in open awareness. Adding an object of focus if that's helpful to you. And now at your own pace, coming back to study and contemplation mode, receptive to the teachings. Lama Jinzang, you're unmuted.
Okay. Are you muted or you're unmuted?
I'm unmuted. Would you like me to mute myself?
No need. I just didn't know because I can't see on this side. You know, I'm not seeing who's muted or unmuted.
I see. Yes, I'm not muted.
Oh, you know what? If I go to a different view, let me just see. No, I can't do that. I don't exit full screen. Oh, I see. If I exit the full screen, then I get it. Okay, never mind. Okay. So I'll start with, can you all hear me? Is this an okay volume? Okay.
So I'll start with the prayers recited by the teachers before teachings, and there are two of them. O Data Semchen Tanche Lo Jusu Jowars and Ji Lapduso, Julam Tu Jowars and Ji Lapduso, Lam Tu Pasawars and Ji Lapduso, Jupo Yeshisu Jowars and Ji Lapduso. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dan lu dan u jin ke ju bu ta ta mi I ke nan tan jo wa kun ji dra ke ji san par tam che ke du da gi chu ten do. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now we're taught to generate within our minds the altruistic attitude of a bodhicitta. And so let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. And in order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So, excuse me, I just have to stand up for a second to pull out my Gompopa text.
Okay. Okay, while you're doing that, anybody who has the sheet, we could chant that first verse on impermanence, just to have that in our minds.
Okay.
We're just going to chant the verse on impermanence that's on that same sheet.
Oh, okay.
Flickering stars and candle flames, illusions, water bubbles, dreams, dewdrops, clouds, a lightning flash, view all composite things like this. And back to you, Lama Jinzan.
So that's what we call this, is the first verse you're calling as impermanence. I'm sorry, what did you just say, Chichen? You're not muted. Oh, wait, hold on.
It's the Buddha's instruction on impermanence. We chanted it last week.
Got it.
Diamond Cutter Sutra, yeah.
Okay, I've got it. Thank you, sorry. So the reason I didn't have in front of me the ornament of precious liberation is I'm not actually going to be referring to this book. I don't know, has everyone read the chapter on samsara from this book? So good. Okay, so I'll be reading from other sources, but that give a synopsis, should I say, without the specific details. So, but as long as you know that you can refer to this to fill in. But primarily I'll be working with Path to Buddhahood and then calling in other sources to help flesh that out. So we'll begin with, I should say, clarification. I'm now in this text of the Path to Buddhahood, and we're going to start today on page 37, where it talks about the second antidote. And I thought I would help to clarify what was confusing to me is what is the chapter itself in the Gompopa text, Ornament of Precious Liberation, which is called the Sufferings of Samsara, is actually in this text begins on the second antidote, page 37, and then completes at the end of page 43, or I should say middle 44, where it then gives the heading Understanding Karma. So Lama Chodron, when she works on the next chapter in the Gompopa text, which is the discussion on karma, she'll be picking up from page 44. So just to clarify how his book is broken down, pages 37 through 44 is the section that we'll be covering that corresponds to the shortcomings of samsara. So I'll begin by reading page 37. Contemplating the misery of samsara. As long as we are in the samsaric state of mind, we will not find complete satisfaction and happiness. Samsara is suffering by definition. So you'll remember in the very beginning of this text, that is how they defined the basic distinctions between samsara and nirvana, was that samsara is pervaded by suffering. And so again, it says samsara is suffering by definition. It is a state of mind characterized by the presence of varying degrees of the three types of suffering. Therefore, we need to get out of it. Fortunately, this is possible. And that is the point of contemplating the misery of suffering. So it's important to remember that when we read about the miseries of samsara, it's not to get us, you know, can be very depressing. And I certainly felt, you know, when you go into the detailed explanation from Gampopa's text, it's very disturbing. But the point is not to be lost to just the feelings of the uncomfortable feelings that arise, but to recognize that this is a point of helping us to resolve to practice, because in fact we can avoid all the types of sufferings that are described. And in this text, it's going to be the three types of suffering. That's the first thing that's covered. So again, is my volume okay? Everyone could hear? Okay. So it says, and again, I'm reading page 37 in Path to Buddhahood. The first form of suffering is what Gunther is, I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, Gunther, but he translated as the suffering of conditioned existence. A literal translation of the Tibetan would be the suffering inherent to all that is composite. And I'm just going to refer now, to help us understand what is meant by that which is composite, a book that I've been working with in another class called The Essentials of Mahamudra on page 55. And so this is just to help us to understand when it says the suffering inherent to all that is composite. So it says, consider the example of a hand. If I hold out my hand, it does the work of a hand. If I put another object next to it, it still appears as a hand. We can see it with our eyes as a solid, single object. If we examine it closely, however, we can discern that it is designated as a hand only through the gathering together of many different things. We can ask, is the thumb the hand? No, it is the thumb. Is the index finger the hand? No, it is the index finger. It is the same with the third, fourth, and fifth fingers. Is the palm the hand? No, it is the palm of the hand. Is the skin the hand? No, it is the skin. If we look for something that is the hand, we don't find it. Yet the hand appears and functions. We might think, okay, the hand doesn't exist, but what about an individual finger? We then carry out the same analysis on a finger. What is the finger? Is the first joint a finger? Is the second joint a finger? What about the third? The answer is always no. There is really no finger there. Rather, there are different pieces that are gathered together. What is seen as a finger is the interdependence of these pieces. It is the same with everything we see and experience. All things are composite. They do not exist as substantial selves. We can apply this reasoning to any part of our body and to all external phenomena. The Tibetan word for composite is duche, which means made of many things gathered together. So that is to give a sense of what it says here, that the suffering inherent to all that is composite. So all of us, as it says, actually all phenomena, that is our own bodies and everything that appears externally, are made together, are composed of innumerable things that we only we put a name to. So we say my body, but our body is a composite of many different things. So that's what I just hope this clarifies when it says that a literal translation. I'm back in this text here on page 37 when it says the suffering inherent to all that is composite. Most people do not even notice this suffering. Everything changes all the time, but we are conditioned to believe the opposite. So we all have this sense that whatever is permanent, we impose upon everything that's impermanent a quality of permanence. And then we think that whatever is like a fleeting source of happiness is a true unchanging source of happiness. So we are continuously deluding ourselves in applying truly existent reality or existence to that which is only appearing in a temporary way. So back to the book, it says, we cling to this belief, thinking that it brings happiness and security. But even the things we most cling to, the ones that seem to bring us the most stability, are transient. We are not free, but conditioned and stuck in our own karma. We are constantly controlled, without knowing it, by innumerable causes and results, which we ourselves have created. So here it's saying that basically, by definition, when we say we're conditioned and stuck in our karma, is that our own conditioning, what does that mean? It's our own chain of karmic actions and reactions. And here to help us understand that, or it helped me understand that, is I went to this book by Mingyur Rinpoche, Joyful Wisdom. And on page 55, just to help give a little more flesh out this thought, it says, the world around us, our bodies, our thoughts and feelings, even our thoughts about our thoughts and feelings, are in constant flux, a progressive and ceaseless interplay of causes and conditions that create certain effects, which themselves become the causes and conditions that give rise to still other effects. So coming back to this text, I'm picking up again where it says, without any control or even awareness of this phenomenon, we cannot escape from it. This lack of freedom keeps us from enjoying total happiness. So that completes the description of the first, also known as all-pervasive suffering. Again, the suffering inherent to all that is composite, that we are under the control, or rather we cannot control, the fact that we are continuously conditioned, meaning that our own chain of karmic actions and results is what moves us forward, is what keeps determining what happens next. And I don't mean determines in the sense of we have no control, as if it's fated, but rather that the choices we make in the present moment then create the results of the next moment, which then in fact becomes the cause of what happens beyond that. So this lack of freedom keeps us from enjoying total happiness. Is everyone clear with that? Okay. So now we'll move into the second type of suffering, which is called the suffering of change. Now this is a little different. I'm going to, because it's very brief, but I'm going to go back to Joyful Wisdom in Mingyur Rinpoche. I'll just read what's in this text, but then I'm going to move on because it fleshes it out a little differently. So again, I'm back here. It says, the second type of suffering is called the suffering of change. This is the anxiety that accompanies our anticipation of change. When we are in an ideal situation, in an idyllic place, we are already dreading change. Even while enjoying a moment of happiness, our mind fears losing it, which is in itself suffering. And so now I'm going to switch over to Mingyur Rinpoche's text, again, Joyful Wisdom, because I feel this is a little misleading, because the reality is that the experience of the suffering of change is actually pleasure. So when he speaks of an anxiety here that accompanies our anticipation of change, it's on a subconscious level. We're not actually experiencing or feeling the fear, but there is a sense of it underlying. So now I'm going to go to Joyful Wisdom. It's pages 53. Again, it's this Mingyur Rinpoche text, to his explanation of the suffering of change. The suffering of change stems more accurately from the attachment to the pleasure derived from getting what we want, be it a relationship, a job, a good grade on an exam, or a shiny new car. Unfortunately, the pleasure derived from external sources is by nature temporary. Once it wears off, the return to our normal state seems less bearable by comparison. So we seek it out again, maybe in another relationship, another job, or another object. Again and again, we seek pleasure, comfort, or relief in objects and situations that can't possibly fulfill our high hopes and expectations. The suffering of change, then, could be understood as a type of addiction, a never-ending search for a lasting high that is just out of reach. In fact, according to neuroscientists I've spoken with, the high we feel simply from the anticipation of getting what we want is linked to the production of dopamine, a chemical in the brain that generates, among other things, sensations of pleasure. Over time, our brains and our bodies are motivated to repeat the activities that stimulate the production of dopamine. We literally get hooked on anticipation. Tibetan Buddhist texts liken this type of addicted behavior to licking honey off a razor. The initial sensation may be sweet, but the underlying effect is quite damaging. Seeking satisfaction in others or in external objects or events reinforces a deep and often unacknowledged belief that we, as we are not entirely complete, that we need something beyond ourselves in order to experience a sense of wholeness or security or stability. The suffering of change is perhaps best summed up as a conditional view of ourselves. I'm fine. So again, that it's summed up, if we have a certain set of conditions, that's what will make us happy. So he gives this line. He says, I'm fine as long as I have this or that going for me. My job is demanding, but at least I have a great relationship, or my health, or my looks, or a wonderful family. And so we turn now back to Path to Buddhahood, page 38, for a brief description of the third type of suffering, which is called the suffering of suffering. This is real suffering, the kind we experience when we are sick, when we are about to die, when we lose what we love, or when we are confronted with what we hate. It is what we usually call suffering. These three types of suffering are constantly with us. We are never free from them. Their presence is the very definition of samsara. The first type of suffering is a neutral experience in terms of sensation. We are unconscious of this process because it does not cause either pain or pleasure. The second type of suffering is linked to the fear that comes with feelings of comfort, of well-being. The third type of suffering is a real experience of pain. Yet if we look deeply at them, all three are experiences of suffering. For the last two types of suffering, this is easy to understand. On the other hand, the suffering inherent to conditioned existence is very subtle. If it is a neutral experience, how can we define it as suffering? I will use a comparison. Suppose we are suffering from a serious illness and at the same time from a small cut on the hand or foot. As long as the main pain is sharp, as long as we are in the grip of a strong fever, we will not feel the minor pains. But as soon as the fever comes down, we begin to feel the cuts. In the same way, the second and third types of suffering keep us from perceiving the subtle conditions of our karma, which truly chain us. Only when we are freed from our grossest sufferings do we become conscious of the subtle conditions of our enslavement. A passage from the commentary on the Abhidhamma says, just one hair gone from the palm of the hand into the eye generates discomfort and suffering. The immature, like the palm of the hand, do not understand the suffering inherent to conditioned existence, whereas realized beings who are like the eye do see the suffering inherent to the composite. The first type of suffering is omnipresent, and even if we do not notice its presence, it is the chain that hampers us the most. The constant change we experience in our lives is part of the same process like the string of rebirths. each change is conditioned, or you can say each change is influenced by a multitude of factors. All phenomena are conditioned or influenced by each other. We are continually carried, pushed forward with little personal choice. Of course, we have a certain degree of choice, but this choice itself is conditioned as long as our mind is not free from attachment and the other mind poisons. The pressures and demands of modern life can give us an idea of the limits of our room for maneuvering. Gampopa illustrates his point with numerous examples, but I don't think it's necessary to look at all of them. Actually, it's enough to open our eyes to see the suffering all around us. So I'll take a break here, and if anyone has any comments or thoughts or questions. So, children, do you have the power to? Andy?
Andy, you're unmuted.
Thanks. You know, I heard these three sufferings described before slightly differently. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. The suffering of suffering was described as because nothing is innately pure because it links them together. Nothing's innately pure.
I'm having a hard, Andy. Could you? You're sort of
anything
coming in. Wait.
Extend.
Oh. Closer. Andy,
could you stop for a second?
Is that better?
We can't, yeah, can you get close to the microphone?
Sorry, yeah, if you can, because you're coming a little bit in and out, so if you can get closer.
Is that better?
Yeah.
If you can talk, start from sort of, I got the part up to where you said you've heard it described a little differently, and then I hard to understand. Okay.
Okay, so the way they described it was that because every experience we have is, because everything composite is innately impure, it can't give you pleasure. And the way you see this is by extending it indefinitely. So like, for example, you start to eat ice cream. It feels good. But you continue to eat it and eat it and eat it, and you get a stomachache. The same thing. It feels good when you're standing up for a long time. It feels good to sit down. When you sit down for a long time, you want to stand up. So that's the way it was described, which is kind of similar, but a little different.
I have a question just about the fact that you said something about it being impure, that everything, could you repeat that part of it? Because that term impure hasn't come up in ways, in the various introductions that I've read. So just what were you saying about it, that the reason it's something is because it's impure?
Okay, am I on? Yeah, maybe impure is the wrong word, but because it's composite.
Okay.
Nothing samsaric has any real pure pleasure that can continue indefinitely. At some point it's going to start as pleasure, but will degrade into suffering.
Right, so I would, from my point of view, I would take out the word impure, because in the terms of, you know, because pure and impure can mean many different things. And I think what we're talking about is exactly that all things are composite means that nothing has the inherent nature of ever as existing permanently as a single entity that has is free of any interdependence. So the point being that nothing from its own side exists with all the qualities that we would, with unchanging qualities. Like you can't say a mountain is big, but if the mountain is big, then how come it is when we move away from it, it gets smaller, that everything is dependent on perspective. And so everything is dependent on your perception. So the idea being, it is just as you've said, that the fact is that everything that's composite is therefore impermanent, and it cannot be then a lasting form of happiness, a lasting form of, again, a lasting form of happiness. So I would just, which I think is in agreement with what you're saying, I just would say that it's the idea of impure doesn't come into it, because, let's put it this way, then you get mixed up between relative and ultimate, because from the ultimate point of view, there is no such thing as pure or impure, because nothing exists substantially that you could say that's pure, that's impure. Nothing has that kind of substantiality to have that kind of lasting quality. Pure or impure are just relative concepts based on individual perceptions. So that's why I'm getting like impure is more of like a relative term, whereas when they talk about the composite, in my mind, it's, you know, anything that comes together is going to fall apart, like it says in the four ends, anything, you know, all things that are composite will, you know, again, fall apart. So I would think of it more as, you know, impermanent, but that still feels like it's a relative description. That's just my point. Lama Jidren, do you have anything else to add or?
No.
Okay. Is that clear, Andy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Impure was just my karmic Judeo-Christian karma sort of kicking in.
Well, okay. Clear enough.
Okay. Okay. Well, I nipped that one in the bud. Okay. So now, hopefully. Okay. So now I'll continue in the text. So here's where Ringu Toko goes off a little, introduces something that's not fleshed out at all in the Gampopa book. But before I go on to that, I'm just going to read the very beginning of the paragraph and then go to a different source. But so here we go. I'm back on page 39. Gampopa also warns us of the danger of being attached to our problems and the risk of drowning in our own sufferings. We must understand their true nature. So here's their true nature is, you know, whether we're talking about ultimate nature or relative. So after defining what suffering is, so on the relative basis, Gampopa describes the specific way it manifests in each of the six realms. So instead of, again, as I said, going into the ornament of precious liberation, which you will have and many of you have read and so know the details, I'm going to now use as a reference. I'm going to be working with The Luminous Mind. This is this text by Kala Rinpoche. And I'm working on pages, it's a very short chapter, 37 through 40 is the chapter called The Six Realms. And also as a reference then, I'm going to be working briefly from, I know that hopefully you all got, or if not, it doesn't matter, I'll be reading, but Lama Chödrön had gone to a, or had a, participated in a program given by Pema Chödrön, which is an explanation of the six realms as she was taught through Trungpa Rinpoche, working with the six realms, each of them being a psychological state. So this was this PDF that she sent. And I'm only going to be working using this text from the point of view where it says the realms. And so what I'm going to do is go back and forth between the brief descriptions in the Kala Rinpoche text, and then also the matching, you know, or I don't know what the word is, but the relevant paragraph in Chidrin's handout. So anyway, it says here, so now I'm reading directly from Kala Rinpoche, page 37. Qualitatively, each of the six mental afflictions engenders a certain type of birth. Hatred leads to a hell realm, greed to a hungry ghost realm, stupidity to an animal realm, desirous attachment to the human condition, jealousy to the jealous God realm, and pride to the divine states, meaning the what we would call the God realms. Quantitatively, these different states result from the accumulation of karma. So a lot of negative karma generates a hellish realm, a little less negative karma, the hungry ghost realm, and less than that, an animal realm. When generally positive karma is mixed with a few negative aspects, we are reborn in one of the three higher realms of existence according to the respective strengths of these karmas. So it's important to say at the beginning that you know, it describes in the Gompopa text where it describes these actual, you know, just brutally, you know, terrible states of vision, you know, what you perceive visually and through your senses. And, you know, I always wondered about that, the fact that, you know, it's so specific. But I guess, like, really, it's like there must be, just like we as human beings perceive or seem to perceive what we think are a certain set of conditions, and then we define them in a certain way, like it's, we'll say later on, like we see water, which is from its own side, it's just this phenomena, water, but we see it as something that we need to drink to sustain life, but if we were to dive into it, we could drown and die, whereas, you know, fish see it as the environment, absolutely essential to life. Etc. So that there must be these types of descriptions that must be the types of images or imagery that does arise in people's minds due to certain states of, you know, the certain karmic causes and conditions coming together, that certain different appearances and perceptions arise in our minds, just like we now can say that we as human beings are perceiving what we see around us, and who knows what each of us are looking at. You know, I think I'm seeing something which, you know, I'm defining as like, you know, a computer right now, and you're looking at something that you're defining as a computer, but who knows if it even has the same qualities. I mean, it, you know, what is your square, my square, who knows? So anyway, starting there, first we'll go into the Kalu Rinpoche, which is just a brief explanation of the hell realm. He says, mind in the grip of anger and hatred produces the karma of a life in hell. What suffers in that hellish state is the mind, our mind. Hellish appearances, beings who attack us or kill us, the environment, and all the suffering that afflicts us in that realm are productions of our own mind conditioned by our karma. So if you think about this, the fact that you look at certain people and you see them immediately as enemies, you try to avoid people, certain people, because you have just this idea that these people are going to harm you and you're feeling afraid of them, or they're going to trigger something in you, so you avoid them. So it's the same idea that you're creating this sense of people being enemies, or, you know, having somehow they pose a threat. So it says, in these infernal states, we are relentlessly tormented by inconceivable suffering. We are killed, and in some hell realms, we experience being killed over and over. We are tortured by extreme heat or cold. And there is no freedom nor any possibility whatsoever to dedicate ourselves to spiritual practice. So now I'm going to switch over to Pema Chodron's this PDF that she sent, Lama Chodron, and I'm now on what appears to be the fourth page, where it says the hell realms. So again, these are, I will say, a disclaimer to make sure that Lama Chodron did ask that no one shares this material because with outside of the class, because these are her personal notes taken during the seminar. So I'm just saying that out loud. So, but again, this is from the point of view of not speaking about specifically the qualities of what the perception within the realm looks like, but where your mind is going and how you experience the realms psychologically. So it says, of the six realms, hell is the super humdinger with the most intense pain and the longest duration. Hell is the projection of an enraged mind. There are two basic kinds of hell. In the hot hells, everything is on fire, burning, similar to the hell of the Catholic Church. You feel like you're on fire, and everything is your apparent enemy, your adversary. In the cold hells, everything is ice on your bare skin, which cracks open from it. Cold anger feels like that. There is no way to get away because everything you encounter is against you. Everything you see enrages you more. There is a sense of opposition to everything that arises. The more angry you get, the more it feels like you're being attacked. As you work with it through awareness and acceptance, it feels like the attacks are letting up, But in reality, what's happening is that you're becoming less angry. So the emotion that's associated with the realm, that can either be the experience, a hellish experience, or the emotion that becomes, if it's the strongest emotion at the time of death, can be the emotion that creates the cause for these hellish realms to be within your your set of perceptions in the next life. And it says these emotions, anger, hatred, rage, resentment, the sense or modality is this feeling of, or she says phrase, you're against me, everything is against me, and that there's absolutely no pleasure whatsoever experienced. And she gives a description of meditative style. She says, I don't know if I want to say this. I think I'll leave this one out. You could read it if you have it or not. But the main point is that, again, the sense of when you're in that emotional, just a moment of insanity, of anger, of hatred, where you're acting and you have absolutely no control. And again, like it says, everyone becomes an enemy. And in that moment, your experience is as if being in hell. You are completely tormented. And again, it says that, so it's the possibility that if your personality in this life, your predisposition in this life, is most attuned to this kind of habit of thoughts arising and reacting in this way, then this becomes the cause for the possibility of being reborn, where the set of conditions described in the Gompopa text could arise for you or something similar. Does that make sense? Okay. So the next is the hungry ghost realm. So I'm back in Kala Rinpoche, page 37. If our mind falls prey to greed or covetousness, the karma that results is birth as a hungry ghost. In this state, we can never get what we want, nor can we enjoy food or drink, which we desperately crave as hungry ghosts. We are always lacking and wanting, yet completely unable to satisfy our desires. And we suffer from hunger, thirst, and constant intense frustrations. It is also a state produced by our mind, and though a little less unfavorable than the hell realm, it is just as miserable. So again, I'm going to refer to Pema Chodron's course, and I'm now with Hungry Ghost Realm. Also very intense suffering, characterized by a sense of deficiency, something wrong with me, poverty mentality, or I could say a feeling of impoverishment. You're always needing something, very deficient identity. Everything makes you feel worse about yourself, like a victim, a loser, deficient. Meditation instructions make you feel bad about yourself. I'll never get it right. Every instruction is proof of your deficiency. Hungry ghosts are depicted as having a tiny throat, as thin as a straw, a tiny mouth the size of a dot, and a huge belly. Always hungry, never enough, always needy, always wanting. The emotion traditionally associated with a hungry ghost realm is greed, but Pema Chodron feels that's not quite it. The quality of experience in the hungry ghost realm is that I always feel like I'm starving, no matter how much I'm giving. The big belly can't be filled down that tiny throat. So the idea is that the forms are described of certain types of these hungry ghosts is that their stomachs are huge, but their throats are so tiny that they can never ingest enough to ever satisfy the size of their stomach. And so she mentions this idea, the story of the Buddha and the beggar who came every day desperate for food. The Buddha offered her a bargain. We will give you food every day, and you just have to say, no, thank you. I don't really need this. He was working with her hungry mind. The real suffering is the hungry mind that feels it is always starving. Kindness provides nourishment that no food can. But this brings to mind what Lama Norla Rinpoche used to say, that when he first went to India, he felt that like the beggars who in India are really without anything. I mean, they're living outside. If they get a big piece of cardboard over there, that's enough to call a home. But the fact is that they had a sense of, from his point of view, they were okay. They had some form of shelter. They felt okay, whereas he felt that those who were the true hungry ghosts were those incredibly rich, which we know in India, especially the time when he first got there, you know, in the 60s, I guess, early 60s is the time when, you know, the rich were super rich. And he said, but those were the most impoverished because they were always trying to protect and they never had enough, no matter how much they had. They always had to have more. So that there was always a sense of need. And in the preliminary practices of Nundro, if any of you are doing them, the point is that in the Guru Yoga, the term jorme means contentment. And what that translates as is without need. So the idea that if you are without need, then you're fine with whatever occurs because you don't need anything. You have enough of whatever you have. So to finish off with the discussion that she gives, she goes, the emotion, greed, which is, this is the traditional notion. And again, the idea here is that if that's your predominant habit in this life, emotional affliction, then not only will you experience these type of, will you undergo these experiences or experience this kind of, well, experience, that doesn't make sense, but you know what I mean? The point is, through greed, you're either going to develop these kinds of responses, the thoughts of, you know, I never have enough, I'm always wanting, or it can also be taught as being the cause to be reborn in the set of conditions as are described in the traditional texts. But anyway, so she says the emotion is greed, and it follows that there's a sense of neediness, a sense of deficiency, a poverty mentality. And the phrase, she says, that's never enough. I'm never enough. I never measure up. Something is wrong with me. And pleasure are fantasies of having enough. So that concludes the description of the hungry ghost realm. And now I'm returning to Kala Rinpoche, page 38. The first paragraph under the animal realm. And he says, the mind can also fall under the sway of blindness, mental dullness, and stupidity, which cause birth as an animal. There are a great many animal species, wild animals, domestic animals, and so on. All of them experience different forms of suffering, such as being eaten alive, struggling against one another, or being subservient and abused. All the suffering found in the animal realm is also the production of the mind and the manifestation of karma resulting from previous negative actions. So this is a really important sentence here where it's twofold. So it's saying all the suffering found in the animal realm is also the production of mind. So again, all these, as we're going through the psychological states, again, all of this, these types of realms can be described as psychological states, meaning they are, in fact, the experience produced by the mind. But it also is saying that the manifestation of karma resulting from previous actions, so that you have a predominance of that particular type of emotional affliction, that can develop and ripen into karma, which is that you can be born in a life where your set of conditions resemble the type that are described in the traditional text. So I'm just going to then refer again to Pema Chodron's brief paragraph on the animal realm. What characterizes the animal realm is often expressed as ignorance, but it's not a lack of intelligence. Have you ever tried to outsmart a squirrel eating all the seeds from your bird feeder? It's not about stupidity, but about routines. It's really like you like things to be predictable, the status quo. You do very well with unpredictability. If your routine is interrupted, you get bewildered, confused, dull, numb. you can't function well at all. In the animal realm, you like things to be the way you want them to be and the way you're used to. You just like the things the way you like them. And the emotion here that this is connected to in traditional texts is ignorance. And she then describes it as feelings of dullness, unimaginativeness, and tied to routine with this phrase, I'm just trying to get by. And what gives you the most pleasure is the routine, staying predictable. So I'm going to return now to Kala Rinpoche's text on page 38, and it says, these three types of existence make up the lower realm states. Amongst them, the most favorable is the animal state. But even in that state, it is very difficult to awaken love and compassion and impossible to practice Dharma. In all of these lower realms, there is no possibility of practicing Dharma and attaining realization. The mind is constantly disturbed by anger, hatred, desire, and so on. Moreover, lower realm beings tend to perform more negative actions, which create still more painful karma. In this way, they perpetuate the conditioning of lower realm lifetimes, which furthermore last an extremely long time. So I thought we could take a break here, because it's kind of intense. And does anyone have any comments they have or thoughts? Okay.
I'm going to unmute John.
Oh,
you did. Sorry, I've remuted you. Now you're good.
Okay. So I was trying to put things into little boxes to understand them as you were telling us this. And I was imagining maybe the difference of, well, starting with, you mentioned fish or water.
Mm-hmm.
And we, fish don't see the water, just like we don't see air.
Mm-hmm.
From a different perspective, someone could look at us like they don't even know they're in this ocean of air.
Mm-hmm.
So that's little differences there. And how we deal with these things in that environment is what we're born into. And this is like the overall way to see things in this environment, so to
mm-hmm.
speak.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so then, let's see, the other point I was looking at was, okay, I was thinking that if you're born into a realm, could it be described as, say, a filter, the psychological states, could they be described as maybe a filter or that we're looking through individually, you know?
I think
within that realm or not? Is that too?
Well, I think it's important that we understand that, in fact, there is no such thing as a physical realm. Because ultimately, it's all mind, in that we know that there is nothing substantial to anything we see. In our coarse perception, we're thinking, you know, this is solid in front of me. It's holding up my computer. There's a piece of wood behind me that if I hit my head into it, you know, boom, that's going to hurt. And it's important to understand that, no, that already is, these are just perceptions. And it's all completely filtered through my mind, not just psychological experiences in the mind, the intellectual, any kind of identification that's taking place in the mind is all within our individual minds. Each one of us is then is thinking that what they're seeing, that first of all, they're seeing something, we're all seeing something outside of ourselves, and we all have this idea that certain things are a certain way, but they're all completely conditioned by how we perceive, you know, our own set of perceptions. We're individual to each one of us. And so I remember years ago, Kempel Sultram saying, you know, Dewachen is right where you are. You know, it's a state of mind. So that this notion of realms is, I mean, when she talks about psychological states, I mean, the idea of realms, it's just that you're like right now, we are born into the human realm. And so we all have a common way, as you said, which is a very poetic way of living in this ocean of air, you know, that we don't see it, but that's our experience of it. And then how we can all fortunately, because we have intellect, because we have precious human existence at this point, oh, granted, each one of us has, you know, I don't have all 16, you know, I don't have like perfect, but again, whatever, of whatever all those different perfect things are, but by the fact that I don't have a perfect memory, so I couldn't begin to give you up the 16, whatever they are. But the point is we all have this precious human existence that enables us to begin to understand that what it is we see is just habitual way of perception, and how everything is described to us is just, again, because we're human. And so as humans, we have a certain way of interpreting what phenomena arises to our minds, because again, ultimately, we can't confuse relative and ultimate, but ultimately nothing around us is anything other than, I mean, even like physics would say, if you were all looking under a microscope, everything is made up of, you know, stuff that's moving. And then if you go into subatomic, everything is ultimately like being in nothingness. It's just energy. And yet as humans, and as humans covered by ignorance, we are unable to see that. And we are constantly like, I think, I don't know if it was Chad or someone once was saying about the idea of, you know, how do we actually perceive? Like, I actually, at one point, when we were doing the 37 points of 37 practices of Bodhisattva, I actually looked up at one point, like, how do we actually see? And all that's actually happening is you can only see something if the object itself, the appearing object, is either has from its own side a source of illumination, like a light bulb or a lamp that's turned on, or if there is light reflected off of it. And then what happens is that light is reflected off of it, and it has to be a very specific angle that then gets reflected into our eyes and, you know, into what appears to the eye. And then it has to be completely, you know, if it's upside down or it's whatever it is, there are all the different rods and whatever that are sending the information to the brain. And then by that point, it hasn't to do with anything that we're seeing. It's our mind then is, I look at my mind as if my mind, which I've discovered is in my upper left arm. I'm just sharing with you. But it's our mind that's interpreting all of this information and then is saying, oh, you know, that's a pillow over there, you know. That's something over there, but there's nothing from that pillow that, you know, has anything to do with pillow. It's like, it really is miraculous that when I think about it, like I get caught up in this idea that, you know, it says, well, there is no one that's thinking this. And yet I get all scared. I'm like, wait a second, there's got to be a director who's making this decision and how are the decisions being made? But I feel like relax because it's already happening that way. And it's like miraculous to me that we seem, even though there's no one doing something, there are these, I'm getting off on a tangent, never mind. The point is that when you say a realm, it's very important to understand that all we're talking about are experiences in our each and individual minds. And everything that how we define anything has to do with what being born into what described as a certain type of realm, the human realm, the animal realm, whatever realm, then we have a tendency to define, you know, what we see or interpret what we see as being the same as other beings who are perceiving within that same realm. I really went off track there. Sorry. Does that help at all or answer or speak to anything you were saying?
It does. You actually circled into it.
Okay.
And you led me on this path and I was like, where am I going? And then bang. Okay. So you're explaining something that I keep forgetting. It's like, I keep remembering. It's like, all right, this stuff isn't, you know, truly existent. And yet I'm putting all these terms to it and I shouldn't. But
that's our
to understand. Yeah.
that's our habit. So we have to really, like, again, so whether you think of the traditional thing that says, okay, you're going to go down and there's going to be, you know, gruesome things happening. But then God knows in the, you know, when they talk about the spears going up through your body, I mean, poor me, I was, grew up Jewish and I went to this temple and I don't know what they were thinking, that we were forced to sit through these movies, these black and white films of like these piles of dead people in the concentration camps, and that we learned about the, these bodies being poked through with all sorts of weapons and stuff. Like, that stuff actually happens. People are actually being tortured in the way that is described. There's waterboarding, there's all sorts of stuff that's actually happening. So, but it's important to understand that ultimately this is all about like how our experiences of a nightmare, where we get in these horrible dream states of just gruesome situations. That's a hellish state, you know, or a hungry ghost, whatever. So it's all happening in our own individual perceptions.
And if I can, while I can still have it here, we share that with other people who are kind of in the same realm with us, hence the you know, the people that say, you know, God wants you know who to be president, or you know what I mean, it's like we share this is where it all gets, where it all becomes relative in a very messy way.
And it's important to understand that we don't actually have the sense of, it's like, make sure that it's not the idea that we share in the sense of like you and I have an apple, the same thing, and we're taking bites from it. Right. But it's that it's known as, it's like a common karmic ripening. So we as a country have common ways of ripening so that we share in that sense, but it's not the same thing. And that's what's confusing for me. It always has been. It's like, how can you talk about us actually sharing some? It's just that for each of us in this sphere of ether right now, wherever we are in cyberspace, we all share some kind of karmic, common karmic ripening, so that we're able to experience this phenomena that is not the same for any one of us. So it's important not to get confused by the term share as being somehow the same thing that we're sharing. It's similar.
Oh yeah, and you just said it the way I was trying to think it, but it was all like balled up in there.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Kathy. Anybody else? Oh, John, I'm gonna. Oh, you can unmute yourself. Just go ahead.
All right, so I wanted to do just one follow-up comment, and it's just that I watched a movie recently. It's older, but it's animation. It was called The Ant Bully, where this kid who used to destroy the ant hills and inflict damage to the ant population gets shrunken down and has to deal with them. And it just came to me, you know, when I was watching it, I was thinking, wow, this is the animal room, because everything was like trying to eat everything else. And it was just a whole matter of survival. I'm like, all I could think of was like, wow, they didn't have no time to practice because they're trying to stay alive. But it was just so timely that, you know, I got to see that. Not recommending to see it. I thought it was interesting.
Well, I mean, you're describing, aren't you, the situation in like Syria and these places where like people are just desperately trying to survive, you know? It's... So there's an example of a hell realm, or, you know, right in our perception. And that's why we've also been taught to like look and see these, whatever you see around you, and think a way to meditate would be to say, well, you know, like for any of these meditations, you could say for any of these realms, like for instance, the hell realm that's described as being just unbearably hot. And you're like, we can't even bear when like a match, you know, when you're lighting a match and like the match head sticks to the top tip of your finger. Or if you're pulling something out of the oven, a hot oven, and you just touch it for a second and you're like, oh my God. In those moments, we're taught, at least Lama Norla Rinpoche would say, well, take that as a moment to imagine what it would be like to have, your entire body immersed in flames like that, burnt to a crisp like that, and then develop compassion for beings who you can imagine in the world are experiencing this, you know, people who are burned to death in various ways, accidentally tortured, whatever. And then another way to work with it is to think, to develop compassion, thinking that, you know, oh my God, that all beings are like my precious parent. And how would it be for my precious parent, like, you know, to whom you feel closest, or your, you know, someone to whom you feel closest, how would it be for them to undergo that kind of terrible torture, and to use these as means to help us develop compassion, and again the wish to develop our practice so that one day we could actually begin to benefit others and free people from this kind of suffering. So these are all different ways. So you could say the same thing for hungry ghosts. You could say when you either experience, like if you've done the Nunye practice, or just it's a really hot day, or you've just been running and exercising, or just working really hard, and all of a sudden you just feel this tremendous thirst. You know, imagine if you couldn't, you know, if you couldn't satisfy that thirst, and how unbearable that is. And then to go through the steps again of those you see out there who are, you know, suffering in that way, or imagine what closest to you suffering and how you couldn't bear for them to be suffering. And then to use either taking and sending at those moments, or to, again, develop compassion and the wish to benefit beings, and to use it to reinforce your wish to practice, to help strengthen your resolve. And so that's how you can work with these teachings. They're not just about, you know, to scare the S out of you. You know, it's to help you look at your own life, see how you couldn't bear it, look at those around you that you can actually see. And now that we have the internet, we can see globally that these situations are going on everywhere. And then also imagining if someone close to you was undergoing this, and use these as impetus to do the different practices of taking and sending, or developing love and compassion. Chidren, yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that this is something that Pema Chidren mentions throughout her course, that it's through our own suffering, for recognizing our own suffering and our own filters and our own realm, that we actually develop compassion for others, because we know what it feels like. Exactly the same thing you're saying. And yeah, it was a major theme of, you know, not of this section, but of the teachings.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like when Lama Chidren was saying before, that Lama Rinpoche said, like, how do you work with impermanence, with the idea of death, is that you don't, when you see someone die, you think, this too shall come to me. So again, the dharmic way of working with what you experience in the world is to see how what you see happening to others, or how you see others' feelings, to look in your own mind and your own self and see that I too experience that, and the suffering I'm feeling, then you realize those beings must be suffering from the same thing, and I'm acting out of ignorance, so they're acting out of ignorance, to develop patience, compassion, loving kindness. So these are the skillful means. So, you know, this is the point of these teachings. They're not just to make people so frightened that they turn away and they don't want to know about it because it's too scary. Which personally is why I didn't actually want to go through the book itself, because it's very disturbing to read, you know, these kinds of descriptions. Okay. Anyone else? Oh.
Well, I've been listening to Chogyam Trungpa's commentaries on the jewel ornament, and what he was saying about this is really what you were saying, the same thing. But he was saying that if you have no resonance for one of the realms, then it doesn't exist for you. Mm-hmm. So sort of like what you were saying, it's not real. Mm-hmm. Only real if it speaks to you, really.
Mm-hmm. And that's also an important point, was that that I didn't bring up, is that earlier in Pema Chidren's paper, it says I'm on the first page here, if you have the PDF with you, and it says that the point is, well, actually, I don't know where it is, but the idea is that the world changes. So here it says, people often aren't sure what realm they're in. We move around. You can be the hungry ghost person or the God's realm person at different times. You realize how fluid it is. So what I'm bringing to mind is when you said if it doesn't resonate to you, that just because it doesn't resonate to you now, it doesn't mean that these kinds of experiences or it won't resonate with you later.
That's right.
And that there is a sense of it not just being one way and realizing others aren't one way either. This is one of the lessons of the six realms. A realm can also be a predominant style, which is where you would say, you know, I'm a human right now in a human form. Has any of these realms ever claimed you as a long-term resident? Is there one that claims you now? So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, thanks.
And I think, Joanne have her hand up?
She's unmuted, yeah.
Okay.
Lama, this is a very basic question, but Gampopa is very explicit in each of his descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Where was this a revelation? Did he experience this? Where did this come from?
Lama Chudrin, can you help me out with this? I know that this is, I mean, I'm assuming this came from the Buddhas and the, you know, that actually describe these states. This is not Gampopa's own personal thoughts. This is not arising. If you were to look at, there's a famous book called The Words of My Perfect Teacher. It comes up there. So Lama Chudrin, can you speak to the origin of this?
No, actually, I don't remember. I'm sure it's in the Buddhist teaching somewhere and we might be able to find that. But yeah, they all teach the same thing. It's identical. Taranatha's three types of beings, same descriptions. So it's in the Buddha Dharma. It's part of the Buddha Dharma. And presumably it's because it's been seen. It's been experienced. There, even in Tibet, there are these women called Dayloks, right? Who die for a period of time. They don't actually, their body doesn't die, but their mind goes and can visit the various realms and see what, you know, what happens to beings there and then come back and tell about it. So realized beings, I think, thank like the Buddha, can actually go and see these things.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think because remember, Lama Chudrin, isn't there the idea that when the Buddha taught, there were some bodhisattvas who would like, you know, cry blood, like they couldn't compare the, you know, the compassion was so great. Yeah. So I do think this, the source is from, you know, from the Buddha.
Right. That's true. When the Buddha told the bodhisattvas about the sufferings of the hell realms, they vomited and whatever.
Patrick?
I guess as a Westerner, it's challenging to wrap my head around something that is beyond perception, and it takes faith and conviction. Thank you.
But you don't have to go there. See, that's the point. And that speaks to more of the Pema Chodron, which is the point is that you don't need to think of something that is like, well, you don't have to go there. You can just look at your own experience and see for yourself when I feel overcome by anger. What is that experience? When I am feeling so needy and I want something so badly. What is that experience? That's a hungry ghost-like experience. And that's what you need to do. And just recognizing that, and then just saying for all beings, like taking and sending, for all beings who have this kind of insatiable hunger or thirst, you know, use that to develop compassion. Use it to train your mind to develop loving kindness and compassion. That's what it really, that's the point of it. You can use it on the path to work with your own mind as a form of mind training. And so you don't, that's why I didn't even bring this book up, because that doesn't really work for me either. You know, it's, and there's no need to, there's, you know, because that's besides the point.
Okay. Patrick had his hand up and he's unmuted.
Maybe how does this relate to the notion that every realm has a Buddha?
I'm not going to speak to that because I wasn't part at these teachings. You're referring to what it says in the teachings of her PDF?
I've heard different times that everyone has a Buddha available.
Well, you know, I've heard that too, in the sense that the Buddhists can go to these realms, like, you know, and there are stories of how they've gone and they've emptied all the realms at once and et cetera. But I've never fully understood that, number one, so I can't really speak to that, but it is taught that, because it's too high end for me that I can't, but again, that there are beings that, you know, Buddhas that go to the realms and can be positively affected. I can't really speak to it because I don't really understand it. Lama Chodron, do you have something to say?
I would just say, first of all, that as it says in the note, she didn't say any more about it. She just mentioned at that one time that every realm has a Buddha. But I think if you're, you know, just as Lama Jinsong has, you know, has brought out, if we look at our own experience, like when you're really angry and you're just totally consumed by anger and somebody is trying to talk you down from it, you can't hear them. It's like until the emotion itself has passed. If you're really needy, no matter how much somebody gives you, you can't really receive it fully because you're stuck in that neediness. So I think if we look at that, you can see how if someone's not in your realm with you, you might not actually be able to notice them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But she did not elaborate on it within the seminar.
Could I make one suggestion there too?
Which sure.
Buddhas dispel ignorance, and each realm has the ignorance of that realm. So I think that's why the Buddhas are there, is to dispel the ignorance of the realm. Sort of like you hand up, say, look, it's all illusion.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Anyone else? I see that we're at 3:30 already. Wow. So I think we'll end here. So we'll pick up next week. Here's the story. So we're chanting. So Tuesday is the Tibetan and Chinese New Year. A concept of a New Year, because there's the Western New Year's, there's the Jewish New Year's, there's whatever. But because of that, we begin tomorrow chanting full days for, you know, 3 days. And then we have continued to practices to turn away obstacles and you know, invite or hopefully create conditions for positive conditions to come. And also then other chanting, then we have Tuesday. And then we actually have on Friday, because it turns out, this is going to be something. 4 days after the new year is Thaisitu Rinpoche's birthday, and Thaisitu Rinpoche's birthday is now the spiritual director of Thupten Choling, so that we have the day before on Friday a practice to chant, not very long, but there's preparation, and then there's a morning on Saturday celebration. So I'm sort of in the thick of it here. So I won't be able to offer the class next week. I will pick it up the following week. And if you have this book, Luminous Mind, we would pick it up on the human realm, page 38 and 3940. That's that whole book. And then the last three parts of Pema Chodron. And then we'll go back and finish up the very, very incredible pages on this text, 39 through 44. So that's how I'm organizing the class.
As for next week, I had thought I might be out of town, but I will be here. And we had a suggestion from Mark that maybe we just have a short class. And so it's completely optional. I'll be here at 1:45 to chant the 37 practices for anybody who wants to join me. And I can stay and let's just, anybody who wants to meet from 2 to 3, we can just talk about the Dharma. We can talk about anything that, you know, is coming up with these teachings, any questions we have, any, you know, anything. So you can come or not come. I'll send out a reminder, you know, before next week. And then we'll finish these teachings the following week, which would be February 14th, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so Lama Chodron, do you want to finish with the prayers? Or
okay.
Okay, yeah.
Unless you'd like to do that?
No, because you do that.
I'll do it.
Yeah. Because okay. I don't remember what you did. I mean, I could do it, but I don't remember what you did.
The four dedication verses is all. All right. All right. I'm going to mute you and I'll just go ahead and
okay.
Lead the prayers. Making sure everybody's muted. Okay. All right. So let's take a moment to gather our attention again. Just come to rest in open awareness in receptivity to the dedication we're about to do. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Come back to rest just for a moment. So I'm going to unmute everybody. One thing we can do with these teachings for the next 2 weeks is reread the Pema Chodron. If anybody doesn't have it, please email me and let me know. And just notice as we go through our day, like what realms do we find ourselves in? And what happens? Like if you find yourself in a realm, what do you do? She has instructions in here. You know, basically you just open out your awareness. Just start noticing things that are outside your stuckness and the realm will dissipate. Hi, Dan. Nice to see you.
Hey. Hello. Hi, everybody.
You look like you're flying in the sky.
Maybe I am. I'm at work right now, so.
You're in the sky realm. Oh, well, I'm so glad you could join us.
Yeah, I can listen in. It's busy work, so I can pay attention pretty closely. So.
What are you doing?
Well, I kind of just make awards for motocross sports.
That sounds fascinating.
So every time I'm working on trophies, I think you can't take it with you. So, but yeah, pretty much I can listen to Dharma talks 8 hours a day straight. So I get a lot of.
Wow.
So.
That's a great job. That's a really good, that's the precious human existence.
Well, thank you for telling me that because some days I don't feel that way.
Dan, for anybody who doesn't know, is in West Virginia. He's a part of our Richmond Sangha and he moved recently, last year to West Virginia.
Lots of snow these days.
Oh, yeah.
So. Yeah.
But I wish I could be a part of the class more often, but at least I get to listen in, so.
Yeah, glad you could be with us and glad everybody could be with us.
Yeah, it's good to see everyone.
Thank you.
So I'll be here next week, usual time for anybody who wants to join me, and see you then.
All right. Bye.